nothing is so fleeting as sporting achievement, and nothing so lasting as the recollection of it.
This is the Couch Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Couch Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Subhash Jayaraman, and joining me today on the show is Aussie left-arm wrist spinner Brad Hogg. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks very much, mate. Pleasure to be with you.
It's absolutely mine. Pleasure is all mine. As you may have noticed, I did not say former Aussie spinner, even though you last represented Australia in 2014, and you were at the time a young 43. Do you ever intend to announce your retirement, or are you just going to let that play out?
I'm just going to let it play out. I retired in 2008, made a comeback, so I don't think we need to announce any other retirements. If I get a phone call to play again, I'll try and go to the doctor and get a few needles in the knee and play again. I really love the game, but I miss it out in the middle. I'm actually playing a game this weekend as we speak in a Vets game over here in Perth, so it's just good to be able to get back out there in that competitive nature. And I've taken up, I'm still bowling, but I'm doing lawn bowls rather than the overarm cricket bowls. And I've got to say, it is extremely tactical. It's harder than I thought. It's harder than it looks. And I'm having just as much fun in lawn bowls as I did out on the cricket field.
That's fantastic. I mean, the story goes that the WA coach asked you to bowl left-arm wrist spin in preparation to face, I believe it was New South Wales. So were you already bowling that style? You know, you were a middle-order batsman coming up in Western Australian setup. But were you always turning your left-arm over, bowling wrist spin?
No, I'd never ever bowled it before that particular moment. Never even knew of anyone bowling it, and we're just coming up against New South Wales a day later. So I'm out there as a batsman, and I didn't even know that what this type of spinner Freddie Freeman bowls. I just thought he was a left arm off spinner, but he was a left arm leg spinner. So that's what the coach asked. Why the coach had asked me to bowl the left arm leg spin to give the players a little bit of or a little look at left arm wrist spin. Probably about three balls before he asked me to bowl that, I'd bowled a bouncer to the captain, Jeff Marsh, and got him in the helmet. So I was bowling medium paces. And I really enjoyed that. But I played first class cricket as a batsman. I came up to Perth from the country, so I live about 204 kilometres away from Perth, and I came up as an all-rounder, a bowler that could bowl a little bit of swing bowling and bat in the middle order. Then I played A-grade cricket as an opening bat and got picked for my state as a middle-order batsman and got asked to bowl leg spin. I'm glad I did because I wasn't good enough as a batsman to make it on its own, so it was good.
I mean, it's phenomenal that, you know, you had never bowled left-arm wrist spin at that till that point. I think that was 93-94 season. And you made your test debut in 96 against India, in India. That's just 2 years of bowling this new type that you've never tried before. I mean, that is a phenomenal race. Like, what is that process?
Well, you should interview one of my close mates here. He's 10 years younger than me, and I used to pull him out of school over here in Perth to go and bowl to him before I'd go on tours. And he basically says, I can't believe when I'm playing club cricket, can't believe you bat us into a winning position and bowl us out of it, and because I just get smashed out grade cricket. And he can't believe that I had success international cricket with the left arm leg spinners because he could just play me off with a stump. But look, it's amazing, and I think that's the message there for young people coming through. Whatever you do in life, you choose a path, you think that path that you've laid down in stone on a piece of paper is going to be the right way to go, but you can't have the blinkers on. You've got to look left and right. You've got to, you know, you're going to come to crossroads in your life, and you've got to be prepared to say, hang on, there's a better option over here on the left, which might be harder, but it's going to achieve the goal. It's going to make me achieve the goal a lot more enjoyably. So, yeah, you sometimes you just got to take that risk and do something different outside of your comfort zone, and lucky it paid off.
I would like to understand, you know, once you choose to be a left-arm wrist spin bowler, what is that? What are the things that you had to do to get to understand that art, learn that skill, you know, get better at it and perfect it as much as you can so that you can actually bowl it to international batsmen? So what was that process?
I'm coaching kids. I'm coaching a few kids over here part-time in Australia. So I'm trying to get them to do things slightly different to what I did. But I was trying to learn it quickly and so that I wasn't forgotten in that first class space, and I was still seen as an opportunity, or as a player that could represent my country in the end. So basically for me, it was just about getting consistent line and length. And length comes first, then line. If I could just get the right length all the time and know that if I'm under pressure in a game, I could just go back to that length with my stock ball, that's what got me out of a lot of situations. But one thing that I wish I'd been told when I first started it, first started bowling the leg spinners and bowling it out grade cricket, was you're not allowed to bowl any other variation than your leg spinner. You just got to bowl leg spinners for the first 6 months and try and work the batsman out with that. And so that's where you manipulate your fields. You've got to be consistent. You've got that perfect length, but you're changing your lines, trying to upset the batsman's footwork patterns. But also you're just slightly changing the fields through your overs so that you're also making the batsman think. And you're trying to make the batsman not just focus on the ball, but you're trying to make him think differently each ball about where he could play or which gaps he's got to go after. So you're learning how to play with a batsman's eyes or mind as well. I wish that's probably one lesson that I'd like youngsters to learn is learn your stock ball, learn how to get batsmen out with your stock ball, learn how to control the batsman with your stock ball. Then all your variations all of a sudden are wicket-taking options rather than defensive options as well. And you learn quicker when to use those variations.
When was that moment that, you know, the penny dropped for you that, you know, you need to have a stock delivery that you can bank on no matter what the situation is? And how much of a learning curve was that to get to that point where you were absolutely guaranteed that you could, you know, deliver the length that you wanted to? Now, considering that you're a slow start, late starter to spin bowling.
I was very lucky. I just bowled hour after hour once I saw an opportunity for this to take me to the next level. I felt that I was never going to play too much test cricket because you had Shane Warne and Stuart McGill there playing for Australia. So I'm not upset about that. I'm grateful that I was in an era where it was so hard to get into that Australian team, and I played a couple of test matches around those guys. But I saw my opportunity as a one-day player in front of those two particular players because I felt I was a better bat and I was more athletical in the field and I was a better fielder in that particular format. So for me, I didn't really know too much tactically in those first 5 years that I was bowling it. So trying to make up for that tactical not having all that tactical nous, I just felt that if I could just be consistent with my line and length and try and bowl as tight as I possibly can and keep the pressure on the batsman, that's where I was going to stay in the game. So I didn't try and, in saying that, I just bowled a different ball every ball. And that's going back to the point, learn to bowl your stock ball.
Yeah.
All day long. Don't use your variations. So, you know, bowling those variations every ball or every second ball, it lost the surprise element of it and the batsmen were just playing me easily.
Absolutely.
And I think that was a good point too. I sort of went off track there a bit.
No,
sorry,
you're good.
But when I was playing in the 2003 World Cup, we had a fielding coach, Mike Young, who's got a baseball background from America. And anyway, I was sitting on the bus with him after one particular game. I didn't really feel that I bowled that well that day. And I was just saying, look, my wronger didn't come out, my toppy didn't come out, and my backspinner didn't come out the way I liked it. And he just turned to me and he said, Hoggy, the best 10 pitchers in the major leagues in America, the thing that differentiates them from other pitchers is that when they're having a bad night, when they know that their variations aren't going to come out as well as they'd like, they'll just go to that one delivery, which would get them out of the game that night with the least amount of damage. So after that, if I bowled a wrong one and it didn't feel right in a particular game, I'd put it in the shelf. So I'd bowl that spell and I wouldn't go back to my wrong one again. But if I had another spell a little bit later on in the day, after thinking about it, if I had a 10-over break, I'd come back on and go to the wrong one early on to see if it was coming out. And if it came out, then I'd go back to it. So it's about learning. It's about utilizing your spells. And if something's not right, well, stay away from it. Stay in the contest with your other deliveries. And that's a bit of advice paid dividends about 6 months later, where I was in a game where things weren't coming out, but the wicket was conducive. You know when you're in those Asian wickets where you see someone like Jadeja doing well rather than Nathan Lyon not doing well? So Nathan Lyon bowls more overspin than what Jadeja does. Jadeja undercuts it. So anyway, I'm sitting there on this wicket in Sri Lanka and I'm going, I'm not getting any bounce. I'm just going to go to my backspinner. So my backspinner is like an undercutter, and I was turning the ball like Shane Warne. It was ridiculous. Awesome. And but that's adaptability. Going to a ball that you can bowl consistently for the whole 10 overs of that one day game and be effective. And sometimes you just got to adapt and change it up. I would have preferred to go for my leg spinner, but it wasn't going to be effective on that particular wicket. I went for the backspinner, and because I was landed the first couple of backspinners on the money straight away and I felt confident with it, I felt confident to go with it for the whole 10 overs. So basically what I'm saying there, if it's coming out and you need to bowl that delivery on that particular pitch, go for it.
I have two things. First one is, was that the match, ODA match against Sri Lanka, was that in 2004 where you took a fifer?
Yeah, so that would have been about 12 months later, wouldn't it?
No, I'm just confirming.
That was the night, and it was just ridiculous. But that's when I started to have a lot more idea tactically about how to go about it. But if you go further for me. So I retired in 2008, and then I came back three years later. So I've been playing a lot of club cricket, the two-day stuff. So I had my test match opportunity in 2007, 2008. If I had that test opportunity coming back in 2011 at test level, I would have been ready for it. Just playing two-day games, I had the patience, I had the tactics down pat. I was just on the game, and I think that's probably why I had a bit more success in the comeback in the T20 circuit, because I'd been away, I'd come back, and I had a different mental approach, different tactical approach, and probably I had captains around me that believed in my thought process as well. And I think that's the other thing with spin bowling. You've got to have captains that believe in your thought process and your tactics, because you're the one delivering the ball. You're the one that knows how you're feeling in that particular moment, and you're the one who knows exactly what you can do out of certain certain moment. Yeah. And I think if you move forward, we're jumping. That's all right.
That's all right. That's
subject
all right.
to subject.
You can yeah. always come back. We can always come back.
Yeah, but you look at coaches. Mm-hmm. And we're so structured with our coaching these days. You look at someone, Paddy Upton, who coaches the Rajasthan Royals, mm-hmm. or did coach the Rajasthan Royals. Very good thinker of the game. But also got a psychology background.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you go in there and you go, right, we're bowling to MS Dhoni. Okay, mm-hmm. we know that he likes the ball out the stumps. We've got to bowl wide Yorkers to him. Yeah, that's fine. Everyone's got to bowl wide Yorkers to him. But what about that particular bowler that is not comfortable bowling those wide Yorkers?
Mm-hmm.
You haven't spoken to him about how he feels about bowling to MS Dhoni with wide Yorkers. And yeah. this is an example that Paddy Upton had. And it's a perfect example for coaches out there, right? If someone's not comfortable with it, executing six wide Yorkers in an over,
mm-hmm.
don't make him bowl that. Make him bowl what he's comfortable bowling at MS Dhoni and set up a plan for his strengths, not MS Dhoni's, weaknesses.
Mm.
Because sometimes you've got to back your strengths to counteract someone else's strengths as well. And gotcha. you've got to back yourself to get in that contest. That bowler, yes, go away, work on wide Yorkers, and hopefully you can add it to your repertoire down the track. But don't go out and bowl it when you're not used to it and youngsters coming through. So just be careful when you're setting plans. Make sure you set plans for the bowler's skills as well, not just for the batsman's weaknesses and strengths.
Hmm.
Good point.
Fantastic point. I mean, you made like, four or five different points, all well said and well taken. I want to go back to one of the things that you mentioned, which is about Warnie and Stewie being ahead of you in the queue, especially in Test cricket. But Warnie was also ahead of you in ODIs. Well, in terms of like he was playing ODIs, yeah. and you know he was there was a spot, the spinner spot was belonged to Warnie, especially after what he did in 99 World Cup. So you know. How is it that, you know, obviously, as you said, you know, you knew you're not going to play too much Test cricket, so you kind of focused on ODIs. And you know, you play the ODIs in 2003, 4, but then there's a big gap again before you get recalled for that, right? So in this meantime, yep. this 4 or 5 year span, how is it that even though you have focused on playing limited overs cricket for Australia, how are you like trying to keep yourself in the right mental space to be ready for an call-up that would come anytime?
I just got to keep believing that that opportunity is going to come. But you don't chase it. You don't force the issue. The times throughout my career where I've forced the issue, so this is looking for a spot, knowing that my spot's under pressure, or there might be a new contract coming around and I'm thinking about, well, if I don't get a contract, how am I going to support the family type scenario. As soon as you take your eyes off what you've got to do at that particular moment, you're gone. So you go back through my careers, and I can tell you when I wasn't focused on what I had to do, I was focused on those peripheral issues outside of cricket, which I can't control. Mm-hmm. If a selector wants to drop me or a selector wants to get rid of me, I can't control that. I've just got to have other things as backup to make sure that I can still earn money to support my family.
Mm-hmm.
That's up for me to have those backup plans. But at that particular moment, my drive is to play cricket for Australia. What do I have to do right now to make sure my name is in the selector's eyes? And all I can do is perform.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is you look at Stuart McGill, you look at Shane Warne. They are very aggressive spin bowlers.
Yeah.
They take wickets. They spin the ball massively. So I'm sitting there. I don't spin my leg spinner massively. Do I go and chase what Shane Warne and Stuart McGill do and try and turn the ball massively? No. What assets have I got? I've got my wrong-un. I've got my backspinner. My wrong-un turns more than those Stuart McGill and Shane Warne.
Mm-hmm.
But their leg spinners turn massively.
Mm-hmm.
But I can beat... I can beat the batsman on both sides with the variety that I've got, mm-hmm. a little more than probably what those two do. Those two probably beating their right-handers outside edge a lot more than what I would, mm-hmm. but I've got better ability to beat the inside edge. So you look at your strengths. So you don't chase and try and emulate what the other bowlers are doing. You look at your strengths and weaknesses and just keep plugging away with them, plugging away with them, plugging away with them, because as soon as you're worried about what other people are doing, you're gone. Hmm. And it's the same everywhere in life. And we've just seen with Glenn Maxwell with the mental health issues.
Yes.
I've written a book and I do a bit for Lifeline over here. Mm-hmm. So the times that I don't mind sharing these because these are these are little weaknesses that creep in, and it only happens every now and then. But if I'm thinking about what Shane Warne's doing and what Shane Warne's got, and Shane Warne playing for Australia, or even the same with Stuart McGill, if I'm thinking about that, I'm not thinking about what I'm doing. I'm not grateful for the opportunities that I have got. Mm. So if I'm bitter about that, my emotions are out of check, and what does that do for my cricket? Mm-hmm. It makes it unstable. It makes me chase the game. It makes me not be able to control the moment that needs to be controlled out in the moment, out in the middle. And it happens with my personal life. Every now and then, I'll have a week where I go, things aren't right, and I'm thinking about other things that I can't control. I'm thinking about what other people are doing that I can't control. As soon as I think about what can I do, mm-hmm. that's of value for myself to achieve what I want to achieve, all of a sudden you're on the right line. And, yeah, actually this is good therapy. you know, if I'm thinking about what I can do for my team, or what I can do for so that team could be in the media, the media group that I'm with, or the cricket team that I'm with, or even the bowling club. If I'm thinking about what I can do for other people, generally the goals that I've got are going to follow. Because at the end of the day, you want to be part of society, you want to be part of a team.
It's a very liberating feeling to think about how you can benefit someone else. You know, it's a very profound point that you're making here.
Well, it's exactly right. You sit there and you look at all these team performances. Now, someone gets 5 wickets, but the bowler at the other end has just done a phenomenal job of keeping the pressure on to allow you to reap the benefits out the other end.
Yeah.
You've got to understand that. You're working as a team, and if you're not a team man, the wheels fall off. And people look outside cricket and go, well, it's an individual sport, but it's a team sport. So when we say individual sport, you're the bowler, you're mm-hmm. the batter facing the bowler. Mm-hmm. But if you don't keep your ego in check and you try and be the hero at a moment that doesn't require you to be the hero, well, the whole team fails, and the performance of your player at the other end, or your partner at the other end, deteriorates because you're putting them under pressure. So, and the roles change with different situations. Absolutely. One day you'll get the rewards. Another day, the other teammate will get the rewards if you work together. And I think that's one thing that we've probably lost in society a bit, is that everyone's becoming more individualistic rather than working together as a team.
I guess it's a sign of the times. And
it's funny, you've got to be selfish in a way, but it doesn't you've got to have your own interests at heart. You can't just forgo everything that you can't have your values manipulated for the betterment of the team. If your values are manipulated for the betterment of the team, well, you've got to move on to another team, basically. So you've got to be able to stand tall to make sure your values aren't imposed on. Mm-hmm. But I think playing with the Perth Scorchers for 5 years and the 2003 World Cup, I don't think you can have any better environment where your values just matched well, my values just matched the whole team environment. And I think everyone felt like that in that group, and everything just ran so smoothly. If there was a problem, it still ran so smoothly. It wasn't a problem, if you understand what I mean. So if we were hit with something, you know, it might have been, if it was a media hype or headline that was trying to crack the Australian team, it didn't affect us. All right. Well, we had that issue. All right, let's address it. Yep, we've had that issue. We're moving on. You know, it was like that. Whereas other times in other team environments, a little headline of the same ilk could have really, well, broke the back of the team, that team harmony. So, yeah, everything's got to be in sync. The stars have got to align.
True. I mean, a lot of the times, you know, you may have the best players, best team environment and everything. Still, you know, you may not win, but, you know. I'm gonna ask you about the 2003 World Cup team as well as the 2007 World Cup winning team, both winning teams that you were part of. But first, I want to talk about two of your variations, the Rongen and the Flipper. When I look up on the Wikipedia for slow left-arm wrist spin, right? This is what it says. In cricket's modern era, Brad Hogg is a natural spinner of the ball who popularized the delivery and has one of the most well-disguised Rongen. Accurate description of, you know, okay, so there's your answer. Can you think of a couple of dismissals in your career, no matter whether it's tests or ODIs or T20s or whatever, where the Rongen was perfectly timed, you know, batsman had no idea, and you're like, yep, that was a piece of art.
Look, there's before we go into that, Mike Hussey could pick me from the top of my top of my mark. So, but I used to bowl to Mike a hell of a lot.
Yeah,
and my mate Shane Lavender, who is his family's originated from India in Chennai.
Mm-hmm.
He will say the same. He could pick me from the top of the mark as well. There's a bit of mystery there, but look, I think if you look at all the wickets, I think my favourite one was Andy Flower in the 2003 World Cup. Darren Lehman, myself, and Ian Harvey had to address the team for the team meeting just to go through what we felt were the plans of the opposition teams, where we felt Zimbabwe were strong and where we felt Zimbabwe were weak. And we're talking about Andy Flower. And I was only just new into the team.
Yeah.
Lehman and Harvey are talking, and it's half an hour on Andy Flower, and I'm just going, just give me the ball and I'll get him out with a flipper. And Buff's just turned around, that's Darren Lehman's turned around and said, Hoggy, that's enough from you, just zip it. All right, no drama. So I knew my place in the team, just new, not boisterous. So anyway, comes to the game, Andy Flower comes in and Grant, his brother's out there, and I bowl the first over. I get swept a couple of times for a couple of singles. Then it's the start of the over, the next over, and I'm out the top of my mark and I'm going, right, I've got to bowl the flipper, but the coach keeps telling me, when you start an over, you've got to go with your stock ball. And I'm thinking, right, John Buchanan. Yeah, I totally agree with him. And then I go back to the family farm and working with my dad now. My dad's known as the Bradman of the country or country cricket over here. He should have played state cricket at least. He was a lot better than what I was. But I'm sitting there at the top of my, right, should I listen to John? Because I never listened to Dad on the farm when he asked me to do something. I always did it my own way. I said, bugger it, I'm going to go with the flipper. Flipper, off stump out of the road, and I'm down celebrating on one knee.
Yeah.
I didn't want anyone to hear what I was saying or see any lip syncing on the TV. But I was going, something like, you buggers will start listening to me now, won't you? And, so that's probably, you know, when you have a little moment like that, that's priceless.
I mean, for people that have not seen the dismissal, It's on YouTube. They should go check it out. It says a killer flipper from Brad Hogg.
Just little moments like that. But you know, when I say there, when I'm saying that, oh, so you buggers will listen to me now. You know, it wasn't aggressive or anything spiteful. It was just the way that the team were gelling at that stage. We're just having so much fun, and you could take the Mickey out of each other, and that's what we did. And I think. You talk about culture. That team was picked. Jimmy Marr was picked as a second keeper in front of Ryan Campbell, and everyone's going, "Why Jimmy Marr? Why Jimmy Marr?" And we got on the plane to leave Australia and to go to South Africa, and within the first, before the plane even started moving from the its bay, Jimmy Marr had the team in absolute laughter, and I'm just sitting there going, "That's why Jimmy Marr is on the trip. He's probably not going to play a game, but he's there just to lighten up the mood when things aren't going right." And you need players like that in your team.
I mean, especially the 2003 World Cup, right? So you go in with Shane Warne as the established number one spinner on the side, but then he gets sent home, right? So how quickly? Oh. I mean, you basically have to step up and be the lead spinner. You take what 13 wickets in the tournament, including that obvious, obviously that flipper to Andy Flower.
We'll go through that. So we're out the Setting Sun in Joburg. Anyway, we're playing Pakistan the next day, and Shane Warne and I are picked in the team for the next day. And anyway, we're sitting down there, we're having lunch in the shopping centre, and all of a sudden, the team manager's running around trying to find everyone, and we didn't have the mobile phones back then. We weren't as technically savvy then, so we didn't have WhatsApp and all that sort of stuff with the mobile phones. And he's running around trying to get everyone, right, we've got a meeting, we've got an urgent meeting, everyone back out the hotel, out fire for this urgent meeting. Okay, no drama. So we get in there and there's no Shane Warne in there. Then all of a sudden the manager walks in with Shane Warne. I'm sitting at one corner of the room and Jimmy Marr's opposite corner to me. And anyway, we've been told what's happened with Shane, and everyone's heads dropped. And Jimmy's got, Shane Warne's done his spiel and all that sort of stuff. And then Ricky's got up and said, right, you know, we're going to have to get on with it, and we're going to have to do the job. Warney won't be with us anymore, but want everyone to sort of go and tell Warney, good luck and all that sort of stuff and wish him well and just console him. And I said, "Punt, sorry, mate. I'll go and pack his bags. I'll take his bags down. I'll get in the cab with him. I'll take him to the airport. I'll put his bags on the plane, and then I'll escort him to seat 1A, buckle him up, and then make sure the plane flies away. I'll help him in that regard because I'm taking the reins here in the spin department." But Jimmy Marr said, "Well, Warney was saying it. Everyone's heads dropped. Except mine," and he reckons I had the biggest smile on my face, and I was feeling sorry for it, but Jimmy keeps hounding me that I had the biggest smile on my face because he knew that he felt that was the opportunity that I'd always been looking for. So but it was quite interesting when he made that announcement. It was like, wow. I was excited. I got that opportunity to be the frontline spinner in a World Cup, and I'd never thought I'd be in a World Cup for a start while Shane Warne was around. But then all of a sudden, the weight's on my shoulders that I'm the lead spinner, and I'm excited. I'm going to do this tomorrow. I'm going to do that against Pakistan. And anyway, I got back to my room, and I'm punching the air and so excited, the energy was just rushing through me. And then I went to the bathroom and then went to wash my hands in the bathroom, and you know how the mirror's in front of you. I looked at myself in the mirror. I said, "You're an Australian cricketer now, you're the lead spinner." And then all of a sudden I just looked at myself and all this weight just came on my shoulders and gone, oh my God, what if I let the team down now? Oh God.
Brother, self-doubt. It's never too far, is it?
Oh, no, the self-doubt just crept in. And, yeah, but, you know, it was one of those things. The next day, Andrew Solomons made that brilliant 100.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone remembers that brilliant 100. And before we got to the World Cup, the media was saying Andrew Solomons shouldn't be there. But the way the whole team got up right behind Andrew Solomons and just cheered him on and then looked out the media box like, this is our group saying, that's why he's here. All of a sudden, my spirits lifted again and that self-doubt went. So, it was, you know, the self-doubt went straight away when Andrew Solomons made that 100. And, you know, that's why being in a team environment is so important, because you thrive off the energy from the other players.
I mean, that's a brilliant point. You know, the more you do something, the more confident you are in your abilities and stuff. So at this point, you know, you become part of the team, you play for a while, you know, you play two World Cups. And then you compare and contrast with another phase of your career where you're not playing as much top-level cricket. So did you notice a distinct sense of self after you started playing for Australia more regularly?
During that period?
Yeah, from between 2003 and 2008. Did you, you know, carry yourself with a lot more confidence, self-confidence, now that, you know?
Not really. I've always been a little insecure and a little unsure of myself, especially through that particular period, because one thing that kind of played on me a bit is... if we went to India, I'd be 12th man for a couple of games.
Hmm.
It just played on me that, hang on, they're not backing me as a spinner. Why am I here? Am I in? Am I out? And, you know, but then the point that I was saying before, if they had Shane Warne here, they wouldn't be making him 12th man. They'd be playing him. And those the self-doubt was in there. But all of a sudden, because I wasn't playing in certain games, I'd start thinking about these other things, about what they do with Shane Warne.
Hmm.
And because you start thinking like that, when you get your opportunity again, you're not on song. Because you're still frustrated because someone else might have been treated differently than what you are. And you can't be successful thinking like that, and you've got to change your mood very quickly. And, you know, sometimes I didn't and sometimes I did. And the times I didn't, I nearly cost myself a spot in the team. And it's anything you do in life. Just give it 100% if it's good enough. Well, you're going to get the accolades. If it's not good enough, well, you're going to have to go back to the drawing board and dive into it again and do a better job next time.
I want to talk a bit about that 2003 side and that World Cup tournament itself. But first, I want to say, you know, 2007, that Australian side, perhaps one of the strongest ODI side to ever play in a World Cup, maybe like the West Indies of 79 come close, perhaps.
What, 2007 or 2003?
2007.
I reckon our 2003 team would have beaten the 2017.
Really? But then the 2007 team just dominated everybody. You know, you won games running away, whereas 2003 you had at least two close games, you know, one against New Zealand, another one against England.
But you've got to be in the environment to understand what I'm saying.
Please explain.
Yeah, the 2003 team, everyone was in sync. Everyone just gelled together, and it didn't matter what situation you were in. You just knew that someone was going to stand up and get you out of it. Whereas 2007, as you said there, you know, we had a bit of an easy run. It was, we had that aura about us that here we go again, you can't beat Australia type scenario because of what's happened beforehand. Because that was the third World Cup in a row. And We didn't lose a game in the 2003 World Cup, and we didn't lose one in 2007. And I just think the pitches over in the West Indies were more conducive to our style of cricket as well. Those two games that you said were close over in South Africa. Those conditions in Port Elizabeth weren't conducive to us. It was slow. It was variable pace off the wicket. And it was tough going, and we're not used to that. We're used to the ball coming onto the bat. We're used to bowling with the ball going onto the bat, and we had to adjust there, and we adjusted perfectly. And it's just more the team environment behind closed doors was slightly better in 2003 than what it was in 2007. But in saying that, We both trips were very enjoyable, and also in saying that, winning the first World Cup compared to your second might have a different feel about it too, and that's probably why I'm probably more emotionally attached to the 2003 to 2007 World Cup. So yeah, it's just different there's probably different dynamics for me personally within the team environment, because there are different personnel in the first 2003 to the 2007 team. On a personal note, I probably had closer friends in that 2003 World Cup than 2007. So all these things play a factor. You might talk to someone else. You might talk to a Gilchrist or a Ricky Ponting. Mm. They might say 2007 was better than 2003. Hmm. But for me, on my personal experience, it's 2003.
On a skills level, I mean, obviously you talked about the tightness of the team and the camaraderie, and perhaps even because of the Shane Warne incident, probably the team got closer. I don't know, or maybe it was Jimmy Marr.
You had Andy Bickle there. Yeah. Look. And you know, the scenario with the Shane Warne thing now, and I don't really want to, I don't want to talk about the Shane Warne thing, because you know, he's such a wonderful bowler and misdemeanor.
What I mean by that is, so you had, from a personal experience for you, and it being the first World Cup winning campaign that you're part of, so it's understandable. But on a cricket skills level itself, was the 2003 team still better than the 2017, you think?
For me, yes. I felt that our 2003 team was better skilled. I think we had better depth in 2003 as well, because we had injuries to Gillespie as well. So you got to think, we had the drama on the first night of the World Cup with Warney, and we came out and blitzed Pakistan. We had a couple of injuries there throughout the tournament. We turned it around and were able to fill those holes that had crept in. So for me, I think we had better balance in 2003, 2007. I think the 2007 team were just on song at that particular stage. I don't think that the 2007 team would be able to replicate what the 2003 team did. What I'm saying there is, I think the 2003 team would have been able to win two World Cups. I don't think the 2007 team would have been able to win the two World Cups.
Fair enough.
That's where I'm coming from.
That's cool. I mean, you lived the experience, so I believe you.
it's only my experience, and this is the thing. As life goes on, sometimes you're clouded with certain events that are happened in the past. It's when I say clouded, you only remember the moments that you remember, and sometimes you fill up gaps on those particular moments and emotions. And sometimes a true reflection is a little distorted down the track. And I think you understand what I'm saying now.
That is true. I agree. I want to talk a bit about T20s. You know, when came onto the scene, the T20s, you know, it was doom and gloom for spinners. You know, they're going to be hit out of the park, etc., etc. But then, obviously, that has turned out to be not true. Spinners hold, big key in T20s. When it comes to specifically left arm wrist spin, considering the kind of variations you could do and the people not being used to seeing left arm wrist spin that much, you know, there are like maybe five spinners, you know, there's Kuldeep Yadav and Sandakan and Shamsi in South Africa and a couple of Afghan spinners. That's pretty much it. You would have thought that there would be a lot more wrist spinners, left arm wrist spinners in T20s, or at least in T20s. Are you surprised, as I am, that there aren't more bowling that way?
I am surprised. Well, I'm not, because I didn't know any left arm spinners when I came through the system. So, I'm kind of not, because it's not an art that's really come on the radar as often as Shane Warne. So, Shane Warne did wonders. But at the end of the day, there's kids coming through all different styles. There's kids that's bowling with both arms, left arm off spin and right arm off spin. So we're going to see a lot more variety as the game progresses now, especially with the introduction of T20 cricket. But, on that particular aspect, I'm so surprised that we don't see more left arm leg spinners in cricket. And, look, spin in T20 cricket is an extremely vital part of any team. And you're seeing teams around the international circuit now playing two spinners instead of one spinner. Sometimes they weren't even playing any spinners out that time because they realised the true value of it. We're seeing here with Pakistan, they've got the left arm off spinner, Imad Wasim. Mm-hmm. He opens the bowling. Then you've got the leg spinner Shadab Khan in the middle order. Same with Australia. They've got Ashton Agar and Adam Zampa. Agar with the new ball, Zampa in the middle overs. It's perfect, because trying to hit left arm off spin in those early overs with the new ball is quite difficult, because the ball skids on. If you hit it on the seam, sometimes it holds up, so you can't get that timing. And you, especially in the first over, you think, right, it might turn, it might not. So you're trying to adjust to those little circumstances as well. So for me, spin plays a big part, whether you're a left arm leg spin or right arm leg spin or an off spinner as well.
I got one last question, Brad. You have a college degree in accounting marketing. You've played international cricket for so long, and league cricket and club cricket and T20s, franchise cricket, and you've been a postman, you've been an Aussie rules umpire, and you've been a TV commentator, and you now produce interesting video content on YouTube and Facebook and Hogs Vlog and Hogs the Pooper during the Ashes, Alice Cooper takeoff. How would you describe your varied interests and accomplishments, and how you have generally, gone on with your life, both in and outside of cricket so far?
If there's one thing that I'd like to have in my personality, is just to control emotions a little bit better. I'm very happy. Most of the time I'm pretty jovial. I'm very positive. But probably the 10% of time that I'm not jovial or positive and I'm in that negative frame, that's one thing that I'd like to be able to improve, to get out of that little slump, whether it's a day or whether it's a week, a lot quicker, because I can get down on myself. I'm a perfectionist, I give everything 100%. But when I hit a brick wall, sometimes I dwell on it for a little too long, but that brick wall is never going to hold me down, if you know what I mean. But that's one thing that I'd like to improve on, that aspect, is just to be able to control that emotion a little better. But at the end of the day, that's what life's about. If the easy road was there, it's not worth taking. you want to have those challenges, you want to be tested, and you want to have variety in your life. My wife is absolutely sensational. In a sense, she's always testing the boundaries for me to try new things, whether it's food, whether it's a new place to travel, whether it's doing something in the backyard, you know, learning how to grow your vegetable garden or something like that. She's always challenging me to do something new, and that's my personality. Is, you know, I've got to be busy, I've got to be doing something new, and I've got to be challenged. And I think everyone should be challenged and motivated to achieve something in life. And don't be disgruntled. This is the thing. Mm-hmm. Achieving something in life doesn't mean that you've played international cricket and you're on the TV. You know, you could be the best mum in the world and not be noticed by the billions of people around the world, but you have so much effect on your community. For me, whether it's a small community, big community, those small achievements are just as big as someone playing international cricket. So, yeah, you got to keep your ego in check, and yeah, don't spoil it. Just appreciate the things that you've got rather than the things that you haven't got.
On that wonderful note, Brad, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time, mate.
Oh, thanks very much, mate. It was quite therapeutic, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Thanks, mate.